it's the 21st of July, and this is episode 102 of the Crate and Crowbar podcast, a podcast about PC gaming, with me, Tom Francis, and...
Marsh Davis.
And...
Chris Thurston.
And that's it, this week. clearly the biggest news of the week is that our Patreon has been really successful.
Hooray! Thanks to you guys.
Yeah, it's been amazing. We're up $400 a week?
Something like that.
Now?
Yeah,
just way beyond, I think, anything we thought we might get. We were sort of wondering if it would even cover our hosting, and it's going to do much more than that.
Indeed. And given us the fun game of checking it every 2 minutes for the entire yeah. weekend, which is something I didn't know you did until I was vaguely connected to a Patreon.
Yeah, but we're very, very grateful. Thank you so much. And it makes us feel very special and loved and warm.
Indeed. Almost like there's a pressure to not ever phone this the fuck in ever again.
Yeah, Tom Senior and Graham Smith.
Yeah, with your dental appointments and your lives.
God damn those people. What else has been happening this week?
Well, an interesting thing happened last week, which I think kind of typifies a kind of well-meaning sort of consumer protection, but also a misunderstanding of how games are made and really the value that people place upon the kind of strictures under which games are made. So there's a new Steam creator group set up, I think, by Total Biscuit, but I'm not sure, which is called the Framerate Police. And in with this Steam creator group, he's, I assume, trying to name and shame people whose games don't come up to the obviously better 60 frames per second.
Inspired, presumably, by the Batman Arkham Knight thing, where it's locked to 30 FPS. And
you know, there are some arguments for why more frames per second is a good thing in certain games, because obviously you get more frames.
Yeah, there's more of them. They put more in the box.
Particularly within that 1 second, you get a lot more.
You get a smoother experience, and there are some games which claim like having a very high frame rate while not delivering that, and perhaps you could, it's worthwhile pointing up those flaws when games don't fulfill their promises. But quite a lot of games have made it onto this list that are hand animated games. And like, I don't know what these people are going to do when they fucking watch Akira or like any feature length animated movie from the last 100 years.
Or indeed most films.
Yes, yeah. They're probably just going to be sitting there puking into their top hats. From actually, the sheer horror of witnessing fewer frames per second than the eye can perceive.
It's her story on this list. Because that's all FMV, right?
So yeah.
Yeah.
Unless maybe if you drag a window around, that moves in beautiful 60 FPS.
I noticed the Banner Saga got on there. A beautiful, beautiful hand-animated game. Like, hand animation. The reason that you can't have 60 frames per second with a hand animation is because you need to draw every one of those 60 frames. It would take somebody a fucking eternity. Which, like, Akira, not a bad film. I think most gamers, even ones who like frames per second, would agree. It's 24 frames per second. And that was really unusual at the time. Like, I think most manga anime films were 12 frames per second max. I think some of Ghibli's movies are at times 7 frames per second. Like, it doesn't matter.
Well, because people get very protective of their right to ignore the difference between criticism and pedantry. And if you start to take that away from them, they get very upset.
I think there is a value when you're looking at games which embody you in a 3D space. Any first-person shooter, for example, there's a sense of connection to that world which is disrupted by having lower frame rates, I think.
Yeah.
But when it comes to observing something from a distance, like, I know, The Binding of Isaac or something like that, you know, that kind of perspective you get in a game, it really doesn't make that much difference.
No. It's like field of view. I can see the argument for it being a mandatory setting on most types of game, because some people will feel a bit ill if their field of view is too narrow, and so on. You know, whether the object of the game is to immerse you perfectly in the scene, then... Mm. Giving players some degree of customization over what frame rate they see that at and how wide it is genuinely useful. But it's also a completely reasonable parameter for a developer to fix or adjust in pursuit of an effect.
Mm.
And the people trying to measure that with a ruler are not going to get very close to figuring out what that effect was supposed to be. It's like the people who used a mod to remove the back borders from Evil Within, which was Mikami's kind of horror game was very well received, had big cinematic style borders around the screen, which was not an accident. There was nobody at that studio who like lent on the giant borders button and you know, oh, doofus, sent the game to print hundreds of thousands of copies without noticing.
There were months and months of preview in which it was said that they were going to do this as well, which is, you know, the intention of it was quite clearly labelled from the start of the project.
And you're allowed to say that that intent didn't result in an effective, you know, an effective effect, or that it wasn't, you know, or you didn't like it. But removing it in order to fix it is, that's like fucking Lucas Special Edition level fucking it up, as far as I'm concerned. Like, that's...
The FOV shot first.
Yeah. Oh! that sounds cleverer than it actually was.
It really wasn't. Yeah. Removing the colour grading from Battlefield and stuff like that. Like, I mean... More
congratulations!
Isn't good necessarily. I mean, you've just disrupted what the artistic director wanted you to feel, and you know, on some kind of, you know, subconscious level when you looked at those images. Either.
Yeah, it's it's just not. It's not a useful thing to police. I think, I think unintentionally, because this is a humorless enterprise, sets it up to be hilarious just by calling it the frame rate police, because that sounds like something you would make up if you were trying to parody this.
I think the party edition of You Don't Know Jack has been branded with this damage 30 FPS. Someone pointed out on Twitter, someone who's upset that that game runs at 30 FPS is not someone you want at your party anyway.
Yeah. God, can you imagine? Jesus.
What have you folks been playing?
I've been playing with the frame rate police would be fucking livid if they ever got wind of this game. I'm playing a game called Caves of Cud, which is spelled Quad, Q-U-D. Not the entire phrase, just the last word of the phrase is spelled Quad.
I hallucinated the rest.
Which is a super old school, epic RPG roguelike, partly procedural adventure with a lot of simulation. It looks, I think it's been in development for a decade or something like that. And I think it started out as an ASCII game of the true kind of roguelike old school. And it's not an ASCII game now with its Steam early access release. It's got a tile set of some kind, but it's still super lo-fi. Like, it's usually just a smattering of one colored pixels on black is any given tile. But behind that crudity, there is great complexity, because it is outside of it's set in some kind of future post-apocalyptic world, way, way in the future, to the extent that everything is completely unrecognizable. When everybody's a mutant, you know, they're like sentient bears and plant people and things roaming around, and you yourself can choose to be a mutant, and you, by fucking Christ, you are a mutant. Like, you can pick like so many mutations at the start, not just like, you know, a third nipple or anything like that, but you have quills. I think the guy I started with was an amphibian, with burrowing claws and forearms, and he could puke slime.
I didn't know your mum was in this, Marty.
Oh, God! Oh.
How will you recover from this burn? I don't...
That was one of your jokes.
Yeah, it was like, so painful.
Now you change your ways.
Anyway, so that's a pretty cool character to start off with in a game. And like, that has fairly significant impact on the way you play. And that's one of probably the less exciting builds that you can go with, I would imagine. So you could have, a psychic robot that clones himself. And, in the Steam description of the game, it says that you can clone yourself, mind control your clone, and hack off your own limbs. Should you want to. I don't think you get very far in the game.
Is that use the clone to hack off the real user?
Yes, right. I think so.
Because I could go either way.
But so that's kind of cool. And there's obviously a lot of, you know, there's a lot of breadth that's given to its combat as a result of that.
If you have four arms, sorry, I'm still talking about clone. You've got your four arms, then you clone yourself, and then the clone cuts off all four of your arms. The clone can then carry those four arms with them as weapons and could quad-wield its own clone's severed arms.
You know, I don't know that that isn't possible. I mean, it does have that kind of level of granularity to it. There's a lot of simulation going on, though. The Steam page also suggests that there is a fully simulated political system that you can manipulate in there. There's, you know, thousands of years of history that you can dig through. The landscape, I think things are generally in the same place when you play the game over and over again, a set of cliffs are in the same place, but they will look completely different. And the towns stay the same, and things are in the same place in relation to them, but the actual geography of each kind of map square changes whenever you go through it, and the kinds of creatures you discover there. So there is a lot of randomness involved. But there is a kind of central quest which you're meant to do, which I think is the thing that isn't quite finished in the early access build. But there's obviously just fucking tons and tons of stuff to do in the game already. But I won't ever get that far, I don't think, because it is just fucking balls hard. And it's balls hard not just because combat itself is just almost instantly lethal if you come across the wrong level guy, and you can't necessarily escape them always. It's also permadeath, so which I don't think is really a great match for lengthy RPGs, because you put a lot of time into that, and then suddenly you're dead, and you got to start all over again. Apparently, you can enable a save game mode from the debug menu, but it's, you know, the fact that it's not there by default or not alluded to in any of the game's text, I think is one of the kind of problems I have with the game, in that it's very willfully obscure in a sort of chest thumping hardcore way, and I don't care. Like, the Steam page had sold me on all this amazing procedural stuff and the simulated systems. I really want to see that, but like, it's just so hard to interpret how you even interact with it. There's no mouse clicking. It's like everything's on a hugely complex game. Everything's on a obscure key binding, and it doesn't help you find them. It doesn't tell you, you know, what mutations are good to have together, which will let you survive the first few minutes of the game, and let alone any kind of ongoing strategy. And I don't know. There's quite a few games of this sort of level of ambition, which also match that ambition, particularly kind of procedural like Dwarf Fortress and so on, that match that ambition with just a resolute lack of interest in helping the player enjoy the experiences. I wonder why those two things so often go together. Like, why aren't there games which actually want me to have fun when I play them, that are those kind of ambitious, highly procedural simulatory games?
So it sounds like it takes a lot of cues from Rogue itself, because that was a game where, you know, you could build up this character over hours and hours and hours and then just lose it in an instant, and didn't explain itself, and it was brutally hostile. So I guess a lot of them, just people making roguelikes, are often probably inspired by Rogue itself or by NetHack or something, some closer derivative of it, and so they just like those things. But I guess, like, I don't know if this is quite what you mean, but Minecraft is a game with massively interesting procedural stuff that does more to make it friendly.
Yeah, it doesn't, but it doesn't have a fully simulated political system and those kind of things, true. You know? You can't go through, I suppose you can to some degree, and if you're playing on a public server, but you can't go through Minecraft and discover the kind of relics of a previous civilization which has been procedurally generated, in the same way that you come across things in Dwarf Fortress and they have procedurally generated backstories, you know?
Yeah, I think it's that the people who are both intelligent enough to make those games and obsessive enough to want to make those games are nerds.
Yeah.
And so are not, just sort of not focused maybe on that initial user experience, or just maybe so embedded in a community that are already used to getting past all that stuff and already have this kind of built-in language that they've all internalized as to how you play a roguelike, that it doesn't even occur to them that it's inaccessible, because the people, they think they're making it just for those people.
My objection isn't that the fact that it looks crude, like the tile set thing. I think I understand that that's a limitation of the fact that you have to do a huge amount of generation, and having simpler graphics obviously allows you to have more variety, and kind of, it doesn't really matter that things don't match up very well, you know, you don't have to have something look cohesive in an artistic sense. I understand that, and that's totally fine. I just feel that there's a kind of resistance and almost hostility towards allowing people to just get into those kind of experiences. I just don't really understand it.
I wonder if there's a point where, if the game is accessible and there's lots of save game options and things, so you can really push and pull at the systems, those kind of precious procedural things that are the heart of the game come apart much faster. That if you are in a position as a player to really test them and pull them apart and see all of them potentially on your first play, they last a lot less long. Not to say they're not sophisticated, but all procedural generation systems get to the point where you kind of understand the parameters within which things change.
Right, sure.
And you see that a lot faster, the easier it is for you to replay specific sections, for example, or to see all the different potential consequences of a choice.
Yeah.
Whereas locking the player into permadeath artificially prolongs the time it would take you to see all of the possible permutations of a thing, or really start to just see the system rather than the world.
I like to think their combat is broad enough, though, that you would still find fascination in that game, regardless of whether the world's generation produced different things often enough. Like, I mean, the character I got, when you level up, you can gain a new mutation. And they're so lurid and fucking crazy. Like, you know, as well as spitting slime now, I can phase through walls, which is pretty great. and as I was finishing my review for RPS, like the premature evaluation thing, I was starting to have fun with the combat, but it was still frequently impossible for me to win certain situations, as far as I could see.
Jack DeKeet, who we've had on the podcast before, tweeted that he's playing it and really enjoying it, but he's literally never won a fight. Everything he's ever encountered in all of his lives has killed him, no matter how early.
Yeah, I've been killed by lily pads, which I think is probably the worst thing I've been killed by in the game. Most humiliating death. They don't even move.
How does a lily pad attack?
I don't know. yeah, they just have massive health pools.
Should you not have tried to just not kill it then?
Well, yeah. I learned that afterwards.
Now I know you don't start some shit with a lily pad.
Actually, they're not so bad when you know you've leveled up. But, yeah. I do like it. I wish that game a good and long future. And I know it's going to find an amazing audience. Like, there's loads of people in the RPS comments saying, this is great! And loads of people giving extremely lengthy instructions on how to min-max different builds and stuff like that. None of which could possibly be apparent to any player of the game, I think. So, I don't know. I just, yeah. I wonder, good luck to them, but I don't think I'm going to play it. I'm going to wait for the baby version to come out.
I kind of sort of predicting that they'll get this. The people who love it now, get into it now, will have got past all the interface issues and stuff, just be plugged into it and know how to play it, and will be giving feedback about, oh, this thing should be harder, or this class should be even more punishing, or like this thing should have more depth to it. And if they listen to those people, then they will add more depth and make it more punishing and keep catering to those people, but never get over the interface issues that, because the people encountering those aren't posting comments on RPS or on the official forums or anything, they're just firing it up, hating it, and leaving without saying anything. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think that's true of a lot of early access games. I don't think it's necessarily a bad strategy for early access games to appeal to a smaller community and try and foster that. But you're right, I think there is a kind of warping effect based on the kind of people who get into games early, as early adopters. And their advice is usually not the ones which would show the game to a larger market. But
yeah. You've all made our noise about that game.
Yeah. What have you been playing, Tom?
I have been playing The Magic Circle.
Oh, yeah.
Which I had played, like, 2 years ago, I think. It was a really long time ago. I was basically testing it for Jordan and co. It's made by John Thomas, Stephen Alexander, and Kane Shin, who are all veterans of either Bioshock or Thief, and I think in System Shock in some cases. And it's the sort of story premise of the game is that you're inside a game that's being built, and it's a long delayed Duke Nukem Forever like, but fantasy. But mechanically, it's the conceit is that you can walk around this world. You don't have any weapons. You can't attack anything directly, but anything moving around, from actual enemies to mushrooms to just any kind of active object, you can edit, and once you edit it, you can change things like how it moves, what it attacks by, who it's allied with, what special abilities it has, and each of those sort of behaviours is treated like an inventory item. So if you edit a dog, as you should immediately, you can take its movement and you can take its melee attack, and those become things that you now own and it doesn't. So when you stop editing the dog, it will have no legs and no mouth and just drop to the ground as a kind of sausage, which you can then pick up and throw around if you wish. That's another thing. You can edit on any creature. And everything you encounter that is an active object this way has exactly the same rules. And any of those things that you pick up, that you take from any enemy, any bit of the environment or like just active bit of stuff, you can plug into anything else, and there's no restrictions on that. So it's the kind of stuff you're encountering is initially these dogs called howlers. Then you find some mushrooms, and you can take that walk movement and the bite attack and put them on the mushroom, and the mushroom grows teeth and grows legs and then waddles around and bites things for you. And then there's like some tortoise-like creatures that you can stand on. And so if you make one of those and then make it fireproof, you can go across lava because you can stand on its back and stuff like that. And that's the kind of puzzles that it has. It'll just put some things a bit out of your reach, and then you've got to figure out how to use your modified creatures to get past it. And it's a really strange structure because it's a big open area. Like from the moment that you get out of the initial plot intro, you are able to explore all of the kind of game space freely and do things in whatever order you like. And the tool set is just kind of amazingly huge and flexible, in terms of like, is it just amazingly powerful as well? And I think it's probably, I don't know whether this is a criticism, but it's so ridiculously powerful that there's just kind of like 27 ways to solve a given puzzle, and the easiest one won't necessarily be the most interesting. The easiest one might be incredibly straightforward, but there are loads of other interesting ones to be found. And because it then piles that on top of a non-linear structure where you can go after any objective in any order, I found that I kind of, early on, I had no ways of tackling most of the obstacles I was facing. Because I played it before, I knew what I kind of wanted. I knew there was a way to make your creatures fly. I knew there was one to give them tractor beams. And I knew there was one for like hive mind, which means if you give one of your minions hive mind, then every other creature of its type will behave exactly like this one, including sprouting legs if it's got legs, or having whatever attack it has, or having it so the same allegiance as that. And so I did that with corpses, because if you go to a corpse and then you give it movement, it just gets up. And if you give it attack, then it just produces a sword from nowhere. And then if you give it hive mind, then I think it's a group thing, actually. Then every corpse you ever encounter of any kind will just get up and join your posse, which is an amazing thing to see. I love it. I had a fantastic time with it, and it's a very strange game in terms of the first sort of half an hour-ish is all plot stuff that doesn't let you play around that much, and then when it lets you out into that open bit, that's about 2 hours of the game, and that part I just loved every second of, and just had crazy solutions and weird shit happening all the time. And then the section after that is completely different, and I won't say anything about it because it's very spoilable. But that kind of middle 2 hours is, for me, that was the meat of the game. That was the thing I really enjoyed. But as I say, it's so open-ended and so like it gives you so much power that it's not like a thing where you sort of come to each puzzle and think, how the hell am I going to solve this? It kind of, like I said, at first, all of them are like that. And then once you get those abilities, like once I had the ability for my creatures to tractor beam, then they could, any flying enemy or any distant enemy that I couldn't get to by any other means, they could just tractor beam him in and kill him. And I had another tool like that called Mind Swap, which was more powerful than I realized when I first started using it. And there's no kind of limit on how many things you can bring with you. So every time I got a cool ability, I plugged it into one of my minions, brought him with me. I think I had like a little robot with Mind Swap, which meant like weird psychic pink tentacles are coming out of my robot, and then my corpses are doing the tractor beam thing. And each one of those is kind of a killer solution. It can solve almost any puzzle. and are using them to get even more killer solutions. Like, I use my tractor beam to get the flying ability, and now my things can fly, and they've got tractor beams. And then the Mindswap guys can still sometimes just jump ahead and solve the puzzle before anyone else even has a chance to solve the puzzle, because it's so good. And so in a weird way, although I love that middle section, it almost felt like... I'm not sure what it needed. Maybe, like, a more linear structure so that they know which abilities you have when you come to face a certain puzzle, or maybe just more difficulties, just more, like, I think there's only one or two enemies that you can't get to by conventional means, and or you know, things you need to get to solve a puzzle. And what I really wanted was, after that middle 2 hours, I just wanted another 2 hours like that, but stepped up to be even more challenging and even more stuff to get around, because I had this such an amazing tool set to kind of to use. You played it, Marsh, didn't you?
But I played it right at the beginning of Early Access. I think a lot of the things that you've just mentioned there weren't fully online at the time I played it. So a lot of the solutions were more prescriptive. I think there were fewer solutions for each puzzle. And I found it quite a few occasions that I'd have come up with a solution myself and it just didn't work and it should have worked.
Right, yeah.
And obviously that fucked me right off.
I had one bit like that. There was one puzzle where I was trying to get someone out of a jail type situation.
Another one.
And I wanted to kind of sort of throw something between the bars or cast something between the bars, and I found lots of little edge cases where I felt it should have worked and it didn't work, and I was getting annoyed at that. But then eventually it did work, and the thing I'd managed to get through the bars was a corpse, which then was programmed to hate mushroom wizards, and which I was then able to make get up and switch to my side and attack a mushroom wizard in order to kill a mushroom wizard so I could teleport a mushroom wizard to solve the puzzle. And the solution that they ended up working was just so convoluted and bizarre and sublime that I kind of forgave it for all the times that my attempts at doing something like that were blocked.
Hmm. What do you make of the story and the kind of allegory about video game creation and all that stuff?
I didn't really do much for me. I mean, it touches on lots of big themes and discusses them in very direct terms. If you want to hear people talk about game design and hear different schools of game design clashing and stuff, you definitely get all that. So if it's something you're just intellectually interested in, then you certainly get that itch scratched. But as a story with characters, that it gets quite dramatic, and it's about personal relationships between these people, but they are so exaggerated and so over the top that I never believed in them. Like, right from the word go, it was kind of almost pantomime. It was, you know, the sort of, what's the word?
Auteur.
Yes, auteur. Game designer who is in charge of this project is such a complete pompous fool, and it's, you know, very clearly established right from the word go that he's a complete pompous fool. And then there's two other main characters who you hear from a lot, and they're each just the absolute caricature of what they could be. There's an obsessive fan who's just the most absurd caricature of an obsessive fan. And there's like a sort of mechanics-oriented, like pro-gamer type person who's just an extremely exaggerated version of that. And so I never believed in those people, and so I never cared about their relationships particularly. And so it didn't work on that level. And it sort of seemed to... At first, I just thought, oh, well, they've just decided to go away from that because it's so exaggerated that it just seemed like a choice. And I noticed, I feel like, I might be imagining this, but I feel like it was only as they came up towards release that they started calling it a comedy outright. Maybe they were always saying that, but like, certainly on Steam pages now, a dark comedy. And when I read that, I thought, oh, that's strange, because I was thinking of it as like a mechanics-driven puzzle game. That's how I would have described it. And so when I started playing and they were so exaggerated, I thought, oh, I guess they've just kind of gone in the pantomime comedy direction. But then the way the plot develops, like I say, just sort of it's all about the...
Yeah, there's some pathos in there, isn't there? Unsuccessful, I'd say. Some pathos.
But played as if they expected me to really care deeply about these characters and what happened to them. Maybe they don't. Maybe it's just sort of, you know, those are the players that they use to tell this kind of allegorical tale about game design.
Yeah, I think that the one major weakness of the story is that it's set up that there's... This auteur has been making this game for a ridiculous amount of time, and the reason that it's a highly anticipated game because his previous game was so amazing and touched people's lives. One of the characters is a QA tester who's like a super fan of the previous game, but nothing about the magic circle, like the game within a game that you're meant to be playing, suggests that this person could design games. And, like, it just doesn't make a case for, you know, any kind of credibility to the, why would people be so in love with this, you know? I guess it's everything
that every work of art that features within it a work of art that has to have some kind of significance has this problem, right? They always, the work of art within the work of art always has to be massively significant to people, otherwise there's no point in making a thing about it. And so you're always saying, this thing within the thing is incredible, everyone loves it. I think they the game that he's famous for is a text adventure, which is also hard to believe. Like, how is he? Because it's a massive deal. Like, they're showing it at
E3, yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever the fictional equivalent is.
E4.
Yeah.
We've thought about that one. And yeah, so that's. And again, it sort of felt like it was playing to the comedy angle. It was almost a joke that this guy would be so famous for a text adventure, because even today, that's unlikely. You know, in a lot of. He's not directly based on any one person, apparently, and I believe that. But superficially, there's a lot of Richard Garriott in terms of just the kind of game he makes and what he's known for and the way that he puts himself into the game as a character and sometimes talks in character and stuff. And in fact, there's a little thread about someone wanting to make his in-game persona killable so that you can kill him, and Richard Garriott would appear in each Ultima game as Lord British and always try and make himself invincible. And I think in every Ultima game, there is a way to kill him, initially just through glitches and like, oh, he technically has 9999 health rather than being invincible. And if you drop a certain thing on his head or trap him in lava or build a thing around him so he can't get out and starve him, he can die.
He was famously assassinated in Ultima Online
during
a live event.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I wrote an article about this for PC Gamer once, the sort of the history of killing Lord British.
Really? Yeah, have you read Austin Grossman's book, You?
No.
Because it covers a lot of similar ground in that it's set in a studio stuck in some kind of development hell, making a sequel to a game which has been, you know, hugely one of the most lauded games of all time. And it's obviously based to some extent on Ultima, that original game, and the MMO, early MMOs and things, and it makes a very good case for why those games weren't just successful and touched people's lives, but why they were horrendously complicated and amazing, pieces of technology and art, and why the people making them were close to being geniuses. I'd have rather had some sense of that from the Magic Circle, but I didn't really get it.
How did you feel about its? It has a lot to say about schools of game design, and is in like story-driven, prescriptive stuff versus mechanics-driven, more player-empowering stuff. And also has a lot to say about whether game designers should be auteurs and have their own vision and stick to it, or whether fans should have a say in it and take over. Did you feel like it made good points about that, or...?
Not really. I mean, I felt a lot of the E4 thing is a bit of a kind of... a good way of encapsulating the whole of its commentary on video games. I think it's just a tiny bit trite and on the nose about this stuff. And the arguments you're talking about are made in no greater depth than you've just stated them, I don't think. There are some nice things in there about bounding boxes and how enemies spawn. At a technical level, I think that will be illuminating to gamers who are completely naive about the development process. Some of the peering behind that, the curtain there, I think that's valuable. But, I think if you know a certain amount about games, then that stuff is just going to feel a bit obvious. I don't know.
I felt like it was sort of, with some of those dichotomies, I kind of came down on one side at times and said, well, because of what's happened in the plot, clearly this side is right, and then would undo that in a way that felt like, I don't know, I kind of wanted to like either make a point or not, whereas it was kind of making points, then undoing the points and ending up saying, I don't know, just saying, well, it's all kind of confusing, which is true. Mm. I think my favourite stuff was the... story-wise, was the little notes you find that are kind of logs of conversations between the artist and the level designer.
Oh, yeah. There's some good stuff there about characters. Designers asking too much of their artists and artists being rather precious and so forth. But I'm sure that stuff is taken verbatim from their yeah. from their diaries.
Is there a possibility for Magic Circle to act as a sort of introduction to these ideas? Because I'm conscious that we, and almost certainly anyone listening to this, is going to be in that position where the various arguments in game design are kind of pretty old news, you know, like given certain drinking games that we respect on this podcast. Like, you know, there's a degree to which, yeah, we're not necessarily the audience for it. But I'd be quite interested in a game that you could give to somebody who, given that, you know, so dark comedy puzzle games are traditionally very good entry points to gaming generally, Portal being the absolute standout tonally and in terms of its mechanics, like one of the best games you can ever give to somebody to impress them why the medium's really interesting. Is there a degree to which you could simply act as a kind of like, hey, this is actually the kind of thing people talk about when they think about the art of games? Like, if you were to show it to somebody who would not necessarily be familiar with that kind of critical discussion, is it an interesting entry point to games criticism, basically, and the kinds of things people discuss? That games criticism isn't just, is it WoW? And what are the FPS?
Yeah, no, I think it is.
That's the name of my next launch mag.
Is it WoW?
Is it WoW TM? Yeah.
I think it would be. I don't know if the actual mechanics of the game make it too technical for a completely that kind of end of naivety to.
Yeah, I also think there's a lot of stuff that's just weird and ambiguous about, like, actually, who am I and who's this guy talking to me? Mm. Like, the developers, you know that who they are, but there's another character who's talking to you all the time, and it's never totally clear who he is. And
it's very reliant on tropes that I think you'd have to have imbibed over the course of a decade or two of gaming. So there's references to System Shock and visually and kind of in the text of it as well. And I don't think the environments would mean very much to you, because it's there are lots of different games in the single game. So as you go through it, you're kind of an archaeologist unpicking different eras in which this was suddenly a sci-fi game and then aborted and became a kind of fantasy game. And all those things are kind of crashed together in a way which I think, unless you were really familiar with the cliches that it's lampooning, you would just find a bit of a confusion. So I don't know. There is in the third act of it, it does do stuff that I think people who are completely game naive and naive about development would find in some small way instructive about how games that are paced particularly. But I don't know if it's sophisticated enough to be informative for people who, say, fiddled with an editor once.
There's a great... something in the third act does a great job of giving you sympathy for developers in a way that I've certainly never seen before. And in general, something worth saying is it's just a really surprising game. You've probably never played anything quite like this, and each part of it is surprising.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have you been playing, Chris?
So, I've been playing... I was away this weekend, and I've been playing Dota 2 and Rocket League. So there's two games I've spoken before about at varying length. I don't think I have anything new.
Dota? What do you call it?
It's Dota 2. And Rocket League. And I don't think... I was racking my brain to think if I had anything new to say about Rocket League other than the fact that I love it, and it's great. And I love it, and it's great. Something about the Dota experience that isn't actually 100% locked to Dota and therefore possibly of interest and isn't going to just fucking sunder our Patreon dollars in a single stroke.
Paid now, motherfuckers.
No, they haven't. That's how Patreon works.
Oh, shit.
Is the tournament experience. Like, I gave a talk in London Video Brains in May about games as sport. And an entry point into that argument, in part to rebuke a total biscuit argument, actually. And one of the points that I came to when trying to write that talk was that games are different when they are sports to when they are games. The same game, I mean. And this is something that a load of people miss when they try and make the kind of semantic argument about one way or another, which is that if you're playing the game as a sport, you're playing a different game to if you're playing it as a game. And sometimes that's really obvious, like StarCraft as 2 as an entertainment package is this huge sprawling thing with a really inventive single player campaign and loads of cinematics and billions of multiplayer modes and an arcade where you can get loads of new modes and shitloads of maps. And as a sport, it's 1v1 on these maps. And that's a really obvious example of the way that games shift when they become sport. But it's not just that someone comes along and places rules on it. It's that the actual experience of playing a game is so different when you are encountering it in structured competition, in a way that I'm more conscious of the fact that I would love more people to get access to, because, you know, sort of online multiplayer isn't for everybody necessarily, and multiplayer's not for everybody necessarily, but there's something incredibly compelling about tournament play or team play or particularly structured competition that, I mean, is probably completely benign and obvious to anybody who played structured traditional sport in any form, but I think opens these games up in a really kind of rewarding direction. So I'm playing this Dota tournament with Pip, Phil Cameron, who's the UK editor of Kama Sutra, and Matt Cox, who's been on the podcast before, and Robin, who is my friend Robin, who's an illustrator, who is also a member of the Hot Dukes. And we created this team, Uptown Dunk, for this games industry tournament called...
What was the team name?
Uptown Dunk.
What happened to Venomancer? I hardly knew her.
This is basically the resurrected version of Venomancer. I hardly knew her, but we lost Pyrian Flax and Shane to pre-International 5 prep. So Uptown Dunk is the resurrected. We came second in the previous recreational, which is a cool experience in and of itself. And I've also played structured Dota as part of the Hot Dukes and other stuff. And so this is a games industry Dota tournament organized off the west coast of the US by a bunch of guys from IGN and. Like a lot of guys from Giant Bomb played in it. I know because we eliminated them on Sunday. they deserve props for being really good, but yeah. And it's sort of taken us to sort of the games industry's internal golf tournament now. Like, this is our kind of way of working some things out. And it's very kind of mid-level Dota, really. Like, it's at a certain tier where no one's particularly good. And to be honest, the team that won last year, who we will play if we win our next game, happen to have been a Dota team since Dota 1 and played together and just happened to all work in the games industry. Huh. And so they're probably the outliers in that they've got these years and years of experience where everybody else is forming teams from their company. Like, we were beaten really handily over the weekend by the guys who made Hitman Go. I think the next team we're facing is from Perfect World. So, you know, it's interesting. But it's not just the practicing and the strategy and stuff. It's the fact that when you play a game like this in an organized sense, it goes beyond being something that you throw yourself into and starts being something that you can actually plan for. And what it opens up, and I think this is true of any game, which is why I don't have to be too specific to Dota, is a strategic layer and an interpersonal layer that is enormously fucking rewarding and would be rewarding regardless of the game. And it's the point where you come up with a game plan, not just to win, because you know what stuff in the game, what is good, but to dismantle the other team, specifically the other team that you're playing. And I have experimented with this when playing in UK Dota stuff, but there's a limited degree to which you can do it, because you don't see the same teams over and over again. Teams rise and fall, go away. Maybe you learn specific players, but, you know, it's not the same thing. Whereas in this particular example, this sort of games industry in-house, you know, this weekend, we were always the fucking underdog. We always have been. I don't really know why, because we came second in the last one, but we seem to always get that from the commentators, that kind of like, everyone's expecting these guys to fuck it up, which is kind of motivating. But you know, we won a really commanding game on Sunday. I'm really pleased, and because we were fucking terrified of the team we were facing. But I'd spent 4 days figuring out what it would be that would beat them. Like, what, like, exactly, because they have a phenomenal mid laner, like a very individually very skilled player, and I'm used to playing in a team that leans really hard on its mid laner. And it was like, how would I beat that? And just the strategic challenge of mapping it out and coming up with a plan to counter it, to make it work against them, is enormously gratifying. Having it work is obviously the payoff. But just the strategic process, which is something you don't get access to in any other form of multiplayer that I can think of. If we play HOTS after this, we jump on, we don't get that thing of like, how do I personally make this one person work against his team when previously he's the core of it normally? Or how do I exploit this tendency that they have? It's what I used to love about learning military strategy. And it's only possible, I think, when you have this huge precedent for the people you're playing against. And maybe you get it if you play the same person at Street Fighter all the time, or you're really used to something. Like, but it's it's mega rewarding. And like, it's rewarding to watch that game again and sort of watch and see it through somebody else's eyes, see it through the caster's eyes, where you sort of see that, oh, they don't really know why this is working yet. And they don't know that, you know, the points at which we're delighted that our plan's coming together or something like that. But also when we fuck up, and when we fuck up, it's because we're not going to the plan that we had. But the plan was sort of broadly intact the entire time. And this sounds like I'm blowing smoke up my own ass, really, but like, it was, but it was this, that was the kind of, it was also a level up point for me, I think, because it was like, I've not pulled that off before, I've tried it, but this is probably the first time that I've tried really hard in the try hard sense of the word and actually have it kind of yield a result, especially, it's nice, you know, a surprising result. Like, I was worried about this team, and having spent all this time coming up with a strategy and having work, and now I have to go away and come up with strategies for every other team we might play to the same degree, because we can't win otherwise. But like, that's still kind of, I'd love to find the game that gave people access to that, but it's not really a game that can do that. It's a social structure, it's some sort of level of play that allows people to strategize at that level.
There's lots of fun stuff in StarCraft II tournaments where players will practice under like a throwaway account so that people can't look at their replays and get too much of an idea of how they play. You can only ever look at their previous tournament performances. And then if they discover a new strat, which is like a legit thing that happens because of the shifting way that the game evolves, and you know, one tactic for Terran might become really popular. And if a Zerg player is sitting there and suddenly realizes there's a way around this, like in practice with his own team who he can trust, he finds a way to reliably beat it. He'll have to be incredibly careful about not playing that on a public server at all. Like, I'll never try it against a real person until the day of the tournament, and it comes into play against like a massive high profile player, and he'll just break out something that just no one's ever seen before. And everyone's just like, fuck, this has just changed how everyone's going to play this matchup now.
It's interesting. Like, I'd be interested to see what we get banned against us next, because we had a surprise pick that partly won us that game, which is a character called Meepo, who's actually five different characters, and so requires an enormous amount of micro skill to be able to play.
By surprise pick, you mean something you thought they'd ban, but they didn't?
No, as in something they weren't expecting us to go for.
Oh, I see.
And it was, I mean, Dota's maths, like, there's a huge amount of maths in a Dota strategy, and it's about numbers over time. It's about how much golden experience you're pulling in over time, and how much power that translates into, and the points at which you can apply that power to win, basically. And the strategy revolved around us having a trump card on that power over time thing. There's a few characters that can do it, and there's one character that can really, really do it, but is incredibly difficult to play because it requires an enormous amount of micro skill. And because this is an American tournament, we're playing on US East. And so, like, the weekend before, I'd asked Robin, who'd be playing that character potentially, play one or two games as that character on US East, but we're not going to play it as a team. Like, so if they're kind of sniping your replays, they might see that you've done it individually, but we would never have run it as a group, because they may well go back and see what we've been practicing, and we won't be on that log. But I just needed to know that he could do it with a 200 ping, which he could, which was kind of, and then that was like, the plan is go, the green light flashes, and we're on. But it's the same thing, and that's what's so interesting about it. And like, that's not a testament to, like, because that stuff scales. Like, that experience is not only applicable to the very best players, because we're not the very best players. You know, this is an intermediate level tournament, really at best. But it's an experience that is only unavailable to people because it tends to be that kind of structured competition, almost like floats to the top of the skill pool. Like, I think games in general, particularly competitive games, could benefit so much from structures that encourage leagues to form. Like, it amazes me that more games like Heroes of the Storm or Dota or League or StarCraft or anything don't give players more tools to set up leagues and tournaments and seasons, even if it's just with their mates. Like, and that's kind of the point with the revolve around to, was that, like, you know, for other people who don't want to go up against the wilds of matchmaking in order to get a rating or to work on their MMR or whatever it is that they value, or their seasonal rank in StarCraft, there should be ways to structure competition within games that just makes that available to people, like Iron Helmet style, where, you know, you get a bunch of mates and you all sign up for a Neptune's Pride campaign or something. Obviously not particularly that.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, where there's a web interface and, you know, you go through the basic rigor of getting everyone set up. And there are obviously tools you can use, but the amount of effort that goes into organising the recreational is extraordinary. Like, it takes some loads of time and loads of effort to arrange casters and Twitch streams and stuff. And you don't necessarily need all that stuff. But you'd think it would be straightforward from a UI point of view to give players the ability to register teams and track league progress within a game client. And, you know, maybe we fetishize kind of Twitch and broadcasting a little bit too much. Then you don't need to in order to kind of get that experience of it. And I kind of want to see more of it. Like, there are a lot of different ways of playing those. There's a lot of different ways of playing every competitive game, whether you queue solo or you queue with a regular stack or you queue with a rotating circle of friends or you do something like this. But this seems like almost the way that these games are supposed to be played in a way. Because it opens big aspects of their, it's almost like getting access to a new game feature. That's kind of the point. It's almost like part of the game itself is locked off behind a wall simply because of a lack of access to the social features and structures that would make it possible.
Is that stuff locked off? I imagine it is in HOTS because they know that it's alluring and so they want you to play lots of games before you can sign up to the
ranked stuff
and the team play. I think you have to hit max level before you can start a team or join a team. We still haven't tried it because so few of my friends.
Yeah, I'm still two levels away. Yeah.
But even if you joined, we'd still need two other people as well. It's only me, you, and Stanton at the moment playing it. Really, my friends. And I don't know why that stuff is withheld, other than the obvious reason that the longer that people play their game, the more likely they are to buy hats and you know, Beatles.
I simply don't. I don't understand the logic for locking off more ambitious forms of competition because I think that's what a lot of people get from it.
Like, yeah, no, I'd be locked into that on a much more committed level if there was five of us and there was a social reason, you know, a social pressure for us to play games together on a regular basis. That seems like that would get people fucking snagged, wouldn't it?
Yeah, this is what's nuts. Like, there's a bunch of companies, Face It is one, ESL is another, Gfinity, all these external esports companies that run big tournaments on the high end, but who have cups you can enter for 100 quid at a time, you know, with your team. And a lot of it involves getting used to external IRC stuff, crazy plugins and websites you've got to get used to navigating in order to enter cups. And that is a barrier of entry that takes you a level above everybody else. And obviously it's daunting entering a competition like that. But I don't know why it isn't in the game client. I don't know why you can't go in HOTS. Oh, okay, even if we all need to be level 50 or something to do it, we've got a team. We will now plug into UK seeding bracket 95.
Is it because the kind of competitive structure of this already exists and there are, like, business relationships that need to be preserved in some way? Like, I don't know how this stuff works, but I know there's lots of money involved in broadcasting and setting up these tournaments, and maybe people who are making these sorts of games realise that they're getting an audience by associating themselves with those companies rather than the other way around, almost.
It doesn't feel like the reward from that would be big enough to hold back the kind of the actual community end from participating in structured competition easily. Like, it's a self-selecting system at the moment because you have to form a team and be willing to sign up for some weird website service in order to be able to play competitively. Only a small percentage of people are going to do that, whereas presumably more good players would rise up and become audience accruing personalities should the system be more open at the lower end. Like, I don't know. It's interesting because honestly, like, I play a lot of solo ranked Dota as well, and that's fine, but it's not the same game.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, that's a game where you attempt to corral four angry racists
into doing... Sometimes they're homophobes as well.
Into doing something vaguely in their own self-interest against the clock. And it's just a different computer game. Like, it's fun.
My friend Zach has what he calls the... Is it Ariana Grande or Grand?
I think it's Grande.
Grande. The Ariana Grande strategy, which is once when playing, I can't even remember if it was Dota or a MOBA of some kind, his team are getting shredded because they're all just doing different things and just he couldn't persuade them to follow his instructions and no one else was stepping up. So one of the players was just called XXX Ariana Grande XXX and he said, okay, she's in charge. Everyone just do whatever she says without knowing anything about, like, whether she was any good or even wanted that role, and just to kind of declare that everyone had to obey what she did. And, I think they pulled together because it doesn't really matter who's giving the orders. Like, just someone giving the orders, everyone following them will be better than nothing.
Yeah.
I'm on like a 9-game streak in solo rank now because I only play characters that can either stop aggression, heal, or, well, basically those two things. So either a hero that lays down a really big wall or a hero that freezes people to heal them. Because those two the options are the perfect options, because they basically account for almost every scenario where it's like, we're not going aggressive enough. I'm going to literally trap the enemy I want you to kill in with us. Or you're going too aggressive. Oh, a wall's in front of you now. I guess we'd better get back briefly until the rest of the team can get here, you idiot.
Yeah.
Do you guys watch any of Evo?
I saw the amazing fail. That was astonishing.
Was this the thing you linked in our chat room?
Yeah, this is the Evolution tournament or event, in which there are many, many tournaments, but it's kind of the heart of the like beat-em-up competitive scene. In one of those matches...
Guilty Gear, I think.
So it was a round, I think, and the guy won the round and was fucking delighted, as well he might be, and stood up and faced the crowd and threw his arms in the air and stuff. And in this structure, like, you're just sitting next to your opponent, like right next to them, looking at the same screen, I think. As he's doing that, the next round has actually started. He thought it was the last round of the set. And the other player just gets a head start on him. And he realizes halfway through raising his arms and looking at the crowd, and then something like spins around and hurriedly tries to sit down. And I think he's actually at the controls when the rat starts, and the other guy gets the first blow in, but he's so caught off guard, like he's just so not ready for it that he just loses, I think, completely. The other guy just gets a perfect round against him because he just can't cope with, like, oh god, what's happening? And then, of course, the other guy gets up and he's throwing his arms in the air, like, really just gloats it up.
The other guy lost in good humour, though. I mean, his head was in his hands, actually, but he was smiling.
It was really nice to see, because he just kind of burst out laughing when it happened, like, once it was over, and then just, sort of got up from his chair and then just kind of curls up into a ball on the stage, just clutching his head.
I think he didn't realise he hadn't won the first round of the best of three, because it's first to, best of three, so he'd won the second round, but he'd equalised, he hadn't won.
And
you need to remember which way round that is.
It's so funny, because he's remembering so many, thousands of incredibly technical advanced points about that game and how to counter certain things. And I was watching it because I was curious about whether I could enjoy watching a match of, like, Street Fighter 4 was the thing I was watching, which is, like, the kind of, I think the final of that is the kind of the closing event of the whole thing. And I'd heard people saying it was amazing, so I was watching after the fact, and I'm afraid I still couldn't really get a handle on anything that was happening. Like, sometimes you just hear a few interesting things in the commentary about... Because obviously they know both characters' movesets in depth. And to me it looked like there's just one character who just always kicks, and then there's one character who always does fireballs. But apparently loads of really different things were happening. Although that guy was constantly kicking the other guy in the face, and the other guy was constantly doing fireballs, but he was jumping over them or blocking them. It's tough to pass what's going on there. I feel like something like StarCraft, it's maybe a bit more visual. It's still chaotic and hard to understand, but if a player has a group of one type of units and they're sending them over, that looks different to if they have a group of a different type of units or a smaller number of larger units, or, like, even if you don't know what any of them are or what any of them do, you can kind of tell, oh, that's a different strategy to this. Whereas this, round after round, I just couldn't tell the difference between what was happening at all.
Hmm.
I heard it was an amazing final work.
Lyoric gets released tomorrow.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He's going to be way OP, but we should play him.
Heroes of the Hearthsworn.
That's the one.
Yeah, that new map's total.
I don't like it.
Dumpo, isn't it?
I'm worried about that game now. One of the things that you mentioned to me ages and ages ago when you were first previewing HOTS was that you were worried that it was going to end up, I think, like League of Legends was the example you gave, where new heroes, because you buy them, are always OP. It's massively kind of just overpowered for a limited time, then get nerfed. So everybody has an incentive to buy them when they're at their most expensive, when they've just been released. And going by the last four heroes in Heroes of the Storm, it does seem like they are all just massively better than the other characters and are slowly being nerfed now. And the guy who's coming out tomorrow, he just seemed fucking impossible. Like, I was watching the video about him, I was like, well, that's not gonna work. He's just gonna win the match. He never dies. He literally never dies.
Oh, that does seem a peak.
Yeah. Anyway.
How does that work? He just...
Well, he kind of pseudo-dies. he's an undead character, so when you kill him, he remains on the battlefield.
Right.
But by hitting you, he can reduce his cooldown timer, and then he respawns exactly where he is. And he can still...
Wait, hitting you how?
With his ghostly form.
Okay.
And he doesn't do damage, but he slows you. He can slow you, which is obviously kind of critical in any fight anyway. I just think that's just not going to fucking work. Does that happen in... Is there a character that does that in Dota?
So, during the great legal Valve Blizzard fucking, you know, character rights washing machine that all these characters are stuck in at the moment, Leoric from Diablo is the Skeleton King.
Hmm.
Leoric in Dota became Skeleton King in Dota 2.
Right.
Though it got renamed Austerian, just to kind of get rid of the actual Diablo proper noun.
Right.
Who gained... His ult allows him to resurrect at the spot where he dies. Immediately. And he slows everybody around him and he comes back.
But that's an ult, not just like a general trait.
It's his ult, yeah. And then, two years ago, during a kind of spate where they renamed a lot of characters that were a bit too close to Warcraft characters or Diablo characters or whatever, Skeleton King, they did actually an event around it. It was quite cute. They did like a kind of big event of like this being this kind of like solar, like this planetary alignment that allowed Skeleton King to get his skin back. So he became Wraith King and he kind of became this kind of like
skin from the moon.
Yeah, moon skin. He got his moon skin and he became Wraith King. Same character, just new name. And then in the last patch, Wraith King gained an upgrade that means that if he gets a particular item, his ult changes so that. I don't know exactly, I haven't actually seen it ever happen, but allies that die near him stay on the battlefield as ghosts for a duration before expiring, which is very similar, I think, to Leoric's passive in Heroes of the Storm, although it applies to allies rather than to
him.
But yeah, so the character in HOTS has an ability that's quite similar to the same character's latter-day Dota incarnation, but not his original one, which is legitimately based on that same character, Diablo.
Yes, and the washing machine keeps on tumbling.
Yeah. But nobody gets sued.
Do you have any questions?
From questions.
Questiones.
Yes, that's the answer.
Yes. I'm holding them right now. Scott writes, "Hello, poddies."
Hi, Scott.
Hi. Last week, episode 100, which wasn't last week, Scott, it was 2 weeks ago. Get with time. You lamented the FPS scene, contrasting the explosion of FPS mods in the late 90s and early noughties with the current bland hegemony of competition FPSs. Graham pointed towards the initial freeness of Unity and UE4 as material that might kindle this environment once again. I somewhat disagree. Growing up in the early and mid-90s, tools like DHACT, ZZT, and the Build Editor introduced me to game development and the broader fields of programming and computer science. These tools were more than the paint-by-numbers level editor in the new Doom, allowing you to script new behaviors and create new creatures by mashing up the respective game's assets. Even as somebody who's been a professional software developer for the past decade, I shudder every time I fire up Unity and am greeted by a blank canvas. The tools of my childhood let me start with a known working base that I would riff off until the original game was unrecognizable. I don't want to downplay Unity and Unreal Engine and all the wonderful indie developers that they've enabled, but I do wonder if the barrier to entry is just too high in the general purpose stuff, and that more people would be inspired to try their luck game building if the difficulty in remixing existing work was proportional to the ambition. The question... Am I nuts? Hams for reading, Scott.
I think we've actually pretty much made a similar point in previous podcasts when we were talking about how paid for mods might affect the modding scene and the kind of level of professionalism that would introduce. And I think from that discussion, we ended up saying that the modding scene was in some ways more valuable than the more powerful kind of editing tools out there for exactly the reasons he lays out.
I remember I sort of had a really the opposite experience where for a long time when I kind of thought I wanted to go into game development and I particularly wanted to get a job at Valve, the first thing I tried was modding TF2 and I just wanted to do the simplest thing. I just wanted to make a no HUD mod. So even if it only worked with cheats on maybe, something where you just hold down a key and the HUD disappears. And I remember just sorting through the files for hours and hours and hours, and just finding all these, learning about how to extract the source files and all these things, and just finding that the hard is just everywhere. It's just in 100 different places, and figuring out, you can sort of shrink it or try and replace it with like empty sprites and things, but I never even got halfway to finishing that, and it just seemed brutally difficult. And I just thought, like, well, game development isn't for me. And then I tried Game Maker, and obviously I had a much better time with that.
I think I can kind of see both sides, because because modifying somebody else's work, hopefully in most cases, allows you to see an immediate return on your effort in a way that, you know, I've done Game Maker tutorials, and I, you know, did the one that I imagine everyone does where you make 1942. And as in the scrolling shooter, yes, 1942, not the year 1942.
I was confused.
I actually recreated the entire year 1942, and having completed
You didn't get through.
Yeah, having subsequently completed the most complicated act of game design that ever been accomplished, I decided to never do it again. No, I made a game where a little plane shot the other little planes, and as happened in 1942, and
dark period.
Yeah. Yeah, the RAF just flying up forever. strafing left and right. I did that, and then I was like, oh, wow, I'm energized by the vast number of ideas I have that I have no idea how to do now, because none of them involve a little plane going up forever, and that's the thing I know how to do. Whereas, you know, making mods for, God, CNC Generals is probably the most substantial or I ever did, or Dragon Age, were like, I've actually kind of seen my will made manifest in this game now, and I will now never do this again, but due to laziness, not due to a lack of knowing that it's possible, which is powerful, even as it was disastrously ineffective. But I don't know. But yeah, but I could totally see that, you know, maybe forcing people to actually make something from scratch and build something that's entirely their own gets them to having a game faster than modding somebody else's work would be. Particularly now in the era where Valve are probably done hiring everybody who ever made a mod. Clement, whose name I'm no longer going to attempt to say in French, writes, "Dear CNC, congratulations on reaching your 100th episode. I only recently discovered your podcast, so I am glad there is already so much back catalogue for me to listen to. God help you. However, I have a minor complaint about sound quality, which prompted my question. You see, I often listen to you guys while driving a battered old noisy Renault 19. I did try that one in French. Renault.
Renault.
I thus have to crank the volume up a bit, which makes any volume spike very painful to my poor drummer's ears, especially in the higher frequencies. My question is thus, do you guys use a de-esser and or a compressor while editing the podcast? If not, that would improve listenability an awful lot and prevent me from dying because I constantly turn the volume up and down while driving. If you already do, well, sorry, I didn't mean to be obnoxious, but I really don't want to die."
Should we address that before he goes on?
Yeah, so that's the first part of this.
We do use a compressor. We're not really audio experts, though, so we might not be doing it right. And there's, as with all things on the internet, an abundance of really shit advice out there.
Indeed.
Yeah. So if you have good advice on how to compress audio using Audacity, which is the free tool we have access to, then please do let us know.
I feel like there are other issues with the
audio, including pigeons.
Yeah. Efficiency, and also it's always a bit echoey, because despite our soundproofing in here, I don't know, it just always sounds that way. Basically because the microphone is not right next to our mouths. Instead of us all having an individual mic, we have one in the middle, and so that's always going to have a little bit of echoing. But the compression thing I thought we'd solved, particularly in comparison to... It's a pleasant noise, I like that noise. If you guys can't hear this is going to be weird. In comparison to the old PC Gaming podcast, when that was first starting, that would go out completely uncompressed, and that really was a nightmare of volume differences. It was essentially on my... MP3 player, impossible to hear our voices even at maximum volume. And then at maximum volume, anytime someone laughed, it destroyed your ears. I think we're better than that, but evidently we have some way to go. So yeah, we do appreciate any advice. Yeah.
Part of the problem I have is that when I listen back to the podcast on my sound system and with headphones and any other kind of sound system I have at my disposal, it sounds fine to me. It doesn't sound too loud when we get too loud. So I do believe people when they say it blows their ears out, but it's hard for me to change the audio quality because I can't judge it for myself.
With this post, I'll put up the settings we use currently for compression so people can critique them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we all use different settings.
I use the ones Tom sent around.
Yeah.
Might tweak slightly, but maybe that's part of it as well, is that we rotate who edits it. So at any given point, it's going through someone's different idea of what good sounds like. And as Marsh says, the only source of advice for this on the internet is universally 11-minute long YouTube videos by very boring voiced men.
I looked up a YouTube video on how a little kind of facet of Adobe Premiere usage. And again, there are lots and lots of 11-minute YouTube videos. but the one I found was wrapped. The actual instructions were wrapped. It was a terrible wrap. The words he was saying didn't make any sense and the music was terrible. But I don't know. That's
good on him for trying.
Yeah, innovative way.
There's only one way that massively subjective YouTube advice could get less useful.
Yeah, he found it.
Yeah. Good for that guy. I wonder if he watched an 11-minute tutorial on making rap.
His level of expertise in rapping, I would say. Poor guy. Anyway.
So that is, so that's our answer to that part of it. Clement continues. Technicalities aside, my less boring question is a follow-up to my previous one about Skyfall. Remember our interlude to being a film podcast a couple of weeks ago. You answered that one at length, thanks, and it led me to a more video game related one. I would say that most of the Bond cliches and absurdities in the second part of the film, Skyfall, are to some extent tongue-in-cheek comments on the history of this series, rather than earnest Bondisms. Do you have any examples of a video game series willingly parodying itself, as if the developers were apologising for past incompetence, or examples of one episode in a series making fun of the developers of a previous one, think Rocksteady versus Warner Brothers Montreal. Thanks again for a great podcast, Clement.
I think I do have an example of this, but it's tricky to say without totally spoiling it. I think GTA 5, I mean, we might have discussed this on the podcast before, but there's an introduction of a character in GTA 5 who rapidly gets horribly humiliated and murdered brutally. And he's quite an important character in one of the previous GTA games. And I wonder if that's... It feels so pointed.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like the makers of that game are making a point about, okay, we fucked up with this character in the previous games. Now there's going to be our catharsis of ruining this. Maybe somebody who wrote that character had a falling out with the studio or something. I'm sure that's not what happened, but that's the kind of level of vitriol that seems to be.
Yeah, it's interesting because, it's hard to. One of the characters involved is about as close as GTA has ever gotten to having an outright anti-hero, where it's a character who is basically 100% good, but is always trying to do right by other people and the world they find themselves in, who exists outside of the law, but is basically a good guy in almost every way, whereas GTA trades in... I thought GTA 4 generally traded in anti-heroes, whereas GTA 5 is a game exclusively about assholes. And they use that as an opportunity to go like, well, fuck this entire idea. We're never making a character you'll like ever again because we're so clever we can make something you hate.
Yeah.
And still make loads of money from it. Saints Row 4 is a really good example of this.
Oh, yeah.
There's fuckloads of really good stuff in Saints Row 4. There's the bit where you get attacked by the previous protagonists of Saints Row 1 and 2. Which don't look anything like you and are mute, but are allegedly you, and that is played for laughs in a quite effective way. Mass Effect 3, really, really, really good for specifically this. Has some amazing jokes at the expense of Mass Effect 1. In fact, I'd say that's probably the best example ever, actually. There's a recurring character, Conrad Werner, in the Mass Effect series, who shows up as your adoring fan in the first game, who wants your photo taken with him, and you can punch him in the face or not. And then, minor spoilers at this point, Mass Effect 2, he shows up, given that you've vanished for a certain amount of time, he shows up pretending to be you in order to fill the gap you've left in the universe, and you can either talk him down or encourage him in doing this. And then his appearance in Mass Effect 3 is this amazing running joke where they resolve almost every dangling stupid thing from Mass Effect 1 in one go. Like, there's the conversation is dynamic, but and probably involves more choices from a previous game than any other part of that game. But it depends exactly on, like, how many... There's, oh man, I could help you with this very specific patent into Prothean technology, but, oh shit, it's an ancient Asari. If only we had a collection of Asari matriarchs' writings that could be collected, one of 20, from different asteroids throughout the galaxy. And then if you had them from Mass Effect 1, Shepard will say, I did actually collect all of those for no apparent reason at the time. And if you get all of those things right, you get an amazing war asset. If you did everything in Mass Effect 1. But it's right. But it's all done to highlight how pointless all the shit you did in Mass Effect 1. Because the scenario which they all turn out to be useful is so absurd and convoluted.
There's a Father Ted episode about like a remote control wheelchair and a prosthetic arm, and it's like, what kind of ridiculous situation could ever require these two items?
It's basically that. I think that's my favourite one. And Mass Effect 3 Citadel, which is the last piece of... last little expansion they did for Mass Effect 3 is
brilliant.
I think
I still played that. I really need to.
Oh shit, you really should. It's so good.
It was so... I often have this DLC where it's like, when I finish playing the game, if I really did finish it, like particularly if it's a game I love, the games I love are the ones I play through all the way to the end when it comes out, and then I'm just kind of, I'm not done with it because I'm sick of it. I'm just, it was such a satisfying like final ending that to go back to it is like emotionally upsetting in some way. I got to kind of like dredge up all the old feelings and kind of re-engage with it.
You should see the extended cut endings because they're really well done. And actually, Mass Effect 3's DLC in general is really good.
Yeah, I haven't done any of it.
So replaying it...
Actually, I haven't done any DLC for the whole series, I don't think.
Huh. Well, I mean, I think...
Except for stuff that like came with it at launch.
So you didn't do like Lair of the Shadow Broker for Mass Effect 2?
Oh yeah, I did do that because I reviewed it.
Yeah, or... Mass Effect 3's all of it except Omega is, I'd say, dead good. And all, like, it fits really seamlessly into the campaign as well. So if you happen to replay that game, it just sort of feels like this should have always been here.
Right.
And then Citadel is, like, the best epilogue that series will ever have. Like, it's very good. It's very, very, very funny, which is different how these things usually go. John Hicks.
We know that guy.
We know that guy.
Mm.
Hi, John D. He writes, Hi, chaps. Regarding your discussion about the perplexing futurescape of cars, as in the film Cars, this has already been much discussed, and there's a compelling argument that it actually takes place in the same universe as Wall-E.
What? Really?
Yeah. So this is spoilers for Wall-E follow. After humanity returns to Earth at the end of the film... It rapidly becomes extinct as the tubby, mollycoddled humans prove incapable of surviving in a post-apocalyptic landscape. Lacking humans to serve, robots craft new forms modelled on the cars that once filled the planet. There's a good write-up here. He gives a link to the Mary Sue and a headcanon article about how this is... Someone spent time on this. Having potentially ruined two otherwise heartwarming films, I may as well go full marketing and ask which previously two unrelated games... you would suggest might share the same universe, perhaps for the purpose of ill-advised resurrection in the white heat of a newish console generation. All the best, John T.
Well, the Magic Circle and System Shock could be linked together, because they're sort of... Magic Circle pretty directly references it.
FIFA and Call of Duty. There's really no reason they couldn't occupy exactly the same world.
Yeah.
Do you think all sports games technically take place in the same world?
Sports world, yeah. Planet sports.
Because they're all just the sports parts of our world.
They do from, but not only from the same publisher. That's what you're getting. It's like the Marvel Universe. That's why it's EA Sports, not, you know, in one cohesive universe. I think it was the tagline.
This is not really answering the question, but all of Brendan Chung's games take place in the same universe, even though some of them are spaceship combat games and some of them are spy thrillers in the 60s. There are just like little references, and one of them's like a zombie apocalypse survival strategy.
There were theories for many, many, many years that Dragon Age and Mass Effect were in the same universe.
Oh, yeah.
Because both of them involve a underground blue mineral that gives people magic powers. Which I think was just a nod at the time, but people weren't taking it quite seriously.
Yeah. That often happens, isn't it? Where there's some kind of just an intertextual joke.
Yeah.
And people are like, it's proof! It's proof, it's all the same, it's everything's linked.
People are probably going to notice that I've reused some sound effects in Heat Signature at that point and be like, oh, they're in the same universe.
Are they?
Or maybe I'm just lazy.
Are they, though?
Probably. Who knows? Whatever, they might as well be. We did a crossover video that explains that they are and how their plots
look. Oh, of course you did. That was your April Fool's.
Oh, joke. Of course, yeah, yeah.
You made a joke you've already made.
The new rebooted Tomb Raider and Kirby's Epic Yarn.
I'd love to see a rebooted Tomb Raider and Spelunky in the same universe. Just a traumatised woman being chased by a very slow bat. Please excuse me while I very slowly shuffle these papers. Jamie writes, I've been playing the dangerously addictive Darkest Dungeon, the adventures of Count Montjoy Montjoy Darkest, the administrator in charge of sending countless heroes to an almost inevitable end against the Swine King and something-something Wilbur. It's been immensely enjoyable. Playing this game has taken over many a day. Often I am happy to give up the time, but there are times when I have come to resent its Civ-like Moorishness. The Excellence Extra Credits series did an episode on exit points in games. It provides a YouTube link, which I'm sure will make its way into the show notes. I, for one, believe the Darkest Dungeon would be improved by a tick box in this options menu to place a hard limit of a dungeon delve a day. This would help those such as myself with low impulse control from cycling between the town and the dungeons in a spiral of ever-increasing numbers and caffeine poisoning. I'm not a game designer, and so my opinion should be taken with approximately 3 or 4 pounds of salt. But an option would give the game, in my opinion, added emotional heft, as each delve becomes a singular high-impact experience, as opposed to a continuum of gradually decreasing experiences. My question is, which games do you believe would be improved, and how, by setting either hard or soft exit points into their structure? Thank you for a lovely podcast, Jamie.
So I'm actually playing a mobile game to which this applies at the moment, called Alpha Bear, which is has art by the artist from Glitch, which was an MMO that that died and went open source, which is kind of cool. but it's a it's just like a word spelling game. You just spell words from letters on a grid, and that they turn into bears when you use them. But you also, your score is dramatically affected, I think too much affected by the bears that you kind of bring with you in your three bear slots. It's unclear what this specifically represents. And you unlock bears as you play, and this one gives you 36% extra score, and this one gives you 150% extra score. So there's a radical difference. And you can use them, you can pick whichever ones you want from the ones you've unlocked, and then after you use them, they have to take a nap. And the ones that give you bigger bonuses have to take longer naps. And the way it basically works out is the difficulty is balanced. The sort of score amount you have to get to in order to progress is balanced such that you pretty much need your best bears slotted into your bear slots. And after your best bears are the ones that take the longest naps, and they take like a day-long nap. So basically it works out to you can only really play one level a day of the ones that you are rubbing up against right now, the ones that you need to get past before you can progress and go on to the next stage, because they keep increasing the score amounts and they give you bears that are worth more points, and at any given stage you need your best bears to get enough points to pass the level. And it feels like bullshit for some game design reasons, but also because I've already paid like, I can't remember what it is, like £4 or something to unlock Infinite Honey, because they also restrict how many games you can play by honey, and that just like every time you play a game costs you a certain amount of honey. And I paid to have it unlocked because I thought, I don't want to play a free-to-play game, I want to buy a game and then have it and play it infinitely. And I kind of have, except I've still got this time restriction where my bears need to nap. And the currency, the currency you can wake them up with is a different one, it's not honey. So I have infinite honey, but honey doesn't wake up bears. You need coins to wake up bears.
That's true.
Yeah.
But the strange thing about it is that I don't really resent it. I have issues, like, I wish the bears were more interesting than just adding like doubling your points, so you have to use that bear because it's just so much better than your other bears. They do have other properties, but the other properties are just irrelevant in the face of how many fucking percentage points they add. But the fact that it restricts you to basically playing one game a day, I quite like in the end. It kind of makes it... I'm not bored of it yet, and most games like this I get bored of really quickly. I kind of burn through them like in 1 day or 2 days, and either I get very far or I don't, and either way I stop playing forever, pretty much. But because this one is not hard restricting me, but sort of hinting that I shouldn't keep playing it for long periods of time, just play like one thing a day, it's lasting longer and maybe working better.
I think it's limited by the fact that it requires an internet connection in order to check that daily timer. It's a really annoying thing. Like, I was in London over the weekend, and it's a perfect sitting on the tube game.
Yeah.
Except the fact that it doesn't work on the tube.
Oh, really? It just doesn't let you?
No.
Huh.
I think they're working on resolving that in some way.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, obviously, Splunky Daily Challenge was a thing that didn't stop you from playing more than once a day, but it encouraged, it sort of set the default as maybe you'd like to play this game once a day.
Yeah, maybe that's exactly the way to do it, to allow you to play anything, but to add extra significance to a single one-shot playthrough.
Yeah.
I love Daily Challenges. I think it's one of the best sort of structural ideas to happen to games in ages, and every game should have them. There's really, there are very few games that have interesting mechanics that you couldn't apply to in some way or another. Like the new Hitman's going to try something similar to that with, like, this character's only going to appear for a day. Go and kill them. Or, you know, but, like, I would totally play Alien Isolation Daily Challenges, where it's like, I'm going to put this particular configuration of things in this environment, try and survive. Like, it's great. Because it does exactly that. It makes the time you spend with the game meaningful and prevents you from over-investing in it to the point where you feel like you've wasted your time.
Mm.
Alexander writes, "Hey, guys. Regarding the Star Citizen Hullabaloo, which is not actually an announced fifth game in that series, but indeed the new module Hullabaloo, can you, out of the loop style, explain what's going on with this project from your point of view? Both sides of the argument look a little bit deranged, and I kind of trust you the most. Thanks, Alexander." So Star Citizen has had a bit of a week and a half. As it's ever having, and the discussion's pretty much the same one that's always been had, which is like, can this project actually deliver on what they've promised, given that the scope of the thing has ballooned so enormously? And internet opinion man Derek Smart,
also a storied game developer of games of a not entirely uncomparable ambition,
came along with but also someone known for
Having opinions,
and not unwarrantedly, but maybe sometimes on the wrong side of fences. sometimes very pointedly so. Came along with an essay explaining why he thought the whole thing wasn't going to happen. And there's a lot of problems with the thing that he wrote. It's very self-aggrandizing. It's constantly pointing towards his own experience of doing a similar thing as proof that what Cloud Imperium wanted to do is impossible. Which is when it's at its weakest, when it's in the "I tried this, and if I can't do it, nobody can" kind of side of things.
No, do you know that thing that's based on some kind of technical understanding of the things he's...
That's the flip side to it. Right. Like, you strip the ego away, and maybe you can see a point, which is that actually these things are hard, and loads of people have tried them. And you know, when we're talking about it, we're talking about the notion of a huge, persistent online space universe with walking around in ships, walking around on the ground, flying your ships into space, discovering new planets, like the dream of the persistent space game Eve, but with in first person, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And he concludes it's simply not possible with the money involved and the people involved and so on. Chris Roberts has since written an editorial about this, or a blog post or something, calling those claims bullshit, explicitly saying that's bullshit and that they can do it and that there's no point aiming small. And that, of course, delivery dates move, goalposts move as the project gets bigger, but that they are factoring it all in and they're building something they know they can make. And pointedly, Derek Smart had his $250 pledge to the Kickstarter for Star Citizen forcibly refunded, which is something that Kickstarter owners have the right to do. They can give you your money back if they don't want you anymore. And so they were like, "Well, here's your $250 on your way." Which is a bit catty.
And they claimed it was because he was using, sort of abusing his access to their backer forums to spread, you know, misinformation and promote his own agenda.
Yeah.
But he said, presumably this must be true, that he actually never posted on their forums. Like, he has, you know, been very vocal critic, but he hasn't been using their forums to do it, in which case their argument sort of falls apart.
And it's such a tricky one, because neither side in this gains sort of immediate benefit of the doubt, I think.
Mm.
You know, I think Derek Smart could have written an article that was a fifth of the length
yeah.
of the thing he wrote that just gave the numbers. Like, as soon as he's talking about how much things cost, that's when it's interesting. When he's wanking on about games, what he's made, it just doesn't, it's not relevant, because game, you know, expertise changes, tool sets change, amount of people involved change, so on. God knows how many studios Cloud Imperium have now, but it's a lot. But on the flip side, it's not simply enough to say, don't worry, we've got this, when the scope of a project has increased so much beyond what it was originally designed to be. Which is not to say they can't do it, it's just to say that it's hugely ambitious.
Certainly untested.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've played with their garage, the space garage that you buy your ships to walk around in, and the fidelity is extraordinary. It's buggy and it doesn't run very well, but the fidelity of those ship models is amazing. Like, you know, they're easily the best spaceship interiors I've ever seen. But they're just spaceship interiors at the moment. And you trust, I guess, when you made that investment, you trust that that work is continuing. But, you know, trust deserves to be rewarded with a product or a result at some point. You know what I mean? Everybody who's put loads of money, thousands of dollars in some cases, there was a poll on like the Star Citizen forums about how much money people have actually spent. And a lot of people have spent, like, something like 17% have spent more than $1,000.
Jesus Christ.
And there are a lot of people in the thread going, like, oh, I'm at 8K now.
Oh, God.
And, you know, whatever. Like, I'm kind of past judging that too much, given the amount I've spent on Dota.
It's not 8K, mate.
It's not 8K. But, and I kind of, you know, I've read, there's been some good articles about this stuff, about how people see it like buying a car, and it's a fantasy they're really invested in. They've always wanted someone to do it, and maybe this is what it takes to get it. Fair enough, but all of those people deserve a moment when those hangar doors fucking open and they take off in the ship that they've bought. And if that doesn't happen, it's an unprecedented disaster.
Yeah, I'd be very reticent to invest that amount of it in a game, even if I had that money to spare. But the investment by itself isn't the thing that raises my eyebrow. It's the prospect of delivery.
Mm.
It is an anticipated. This will be the first time a project like this will ever come to fruition. There is no real precedent for a game on this scale with this many studios, this sort of funding ever succeeding, because it's the first one. So to put $8,000 of your money on that coming to fruition seems just ludicrously kind of foolish to me.
Personally. But it's also hope, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't Star Citizen like the Jeremy Corbyn of space?
Well, yeah, with fewer anti-Semitic friends, let's hope.
Yeah,
but
So I haven't been keeping up that closely with either of them. What is the difference between Star Citizen and Elite in terms of ambition?
Well, I mean, Star Citizen's going for like landing on planets, like proper walking around inside your ship. So in the current module that exists, there's like the VR arena commander stuff, which it's actually pretty impressive in some ways. Again, technically, the engine needs work, I think, in order to run well. But what you get at the moment is a big hangar, different kinds of hangars, and you can walk around in first person and get in your ships. And these are kind of incredibly detailed devices. You can get in the beds, you can sit on the chairs, you can open the doors and lower the hatches and use the lifts and stuff. And the interior of the ship is far more detailed than anything Elite has ever done. Elite shows you a cockpit. This is and it is genuinely impressive. It feels like every interval ship environment. And it's of a level of detail with something like Alien Isolation in terms of like that kind of incredible, you know, focus. There's some really weird stuff, like one of the luxury ships has a toilet, as a ship should. But the toilet is like entirely behind a frosted glass window, which would be pretty transparent if someone was having a poo in there. But you can't currently bring a player in to have a look, you know, to see what someone else would look like in there. But knowing what I know about frosted glass, and imagining you wouldn't see like anything gruesome, but you could see some naked legs, you know what I mean? Like, you'd see that there's a man pooing. And that toilet is like pretty much on the bridge with the glass facing the bridge. So if you were sat in the captain's chair of that ship...
Maybe it's a really disinhibited future. Maybe people are just okay with their body functions. But like, maybe they bred out pooing in some way.
Imagine that you were on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Right.
The next generation Enterprise.
Take the bridge, number one, I'm off to do it, number two.
Exactly. But you can see Picard and all the other characters, they sat around, and then in the background, through a frosted glass window, Worf is taking a shit. That's completely irrelevant. It's a testament how detailed that ship model is, but I have some questions about the utilitarian design of that ship. Maybe that's, you know, when you're reviewing the ship in universe, you know? Like, this is great, but why do you poo in full view of the entire bridge? But that's what they're going for. They're going for that level of fidelity. So realistic and so compelling in its detail that you can be
horrified
by where the toilet is. Which is great. But and when that all fits together, when that fits together with the FPS module and the MMO and the space stuff and the landing on planets and the trading and the combat and the exploration and everything else, you have the game you dreamed of when you played Elite, right? Which is the one where your life outside of that ship extends just that little bit further. Like, right. It's a really compelling idea. Hmm. I really want it to work. And it's that thing, like, it is this blind hope, because you're like, well, no one's ever pulled this off. Ever. Like, this has always been one of the great white whales of games design. Like, how do you make all of the different types of games people have ever made stitch together into one mega game that you can just live in? And so, of course, you're willing to spend thousands and thousands of dollars, because you're not talking about a game at that point. You're talking about, like, your ticket to, you know, your life, but in space. And it's so compelling.
I hope that the people who spent £8,000 on it have already purchased £8,000 worth of pleasure in having invested in it.
Yeah, that's what I hope.
Because if their pleasure from investing it is contingent on delivery, then that could be a worry.
Or delivery on the lofty things, yeah.
At the same time, I hope we don't live in that world where they're, like, they can just spend $8,000 and feel that pleasure just from having spent it. There's something kind of gross about that. Like, I just feel good because I spent that much money on fucking space, and even if I never get it, it's still worth it just to show I had this badge of
privilege. Well, at least then you'll know.
Privilege.
Like, you know, if it can't be done with this money and this amount of people, then it probably can't be done, at least on current technology. But that's still a bitter pill. Like, it's not... It's one of those things I genuinely am on the fence about, because I desperately want it to succeed.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a lot of people... I think it's easy to say that it'll fail, and that would be a huge shame, because everyone wants this game to exist. Like, if it exists, if it happens, it's amazing. We'll all be playing. Like, we'll all be at least tooling around in it, seeing the sights and...
Yeah, definitely.
Having fun. If it doesn't happen, I just really hope the people who are that far in have some recourse, whether or not it's money back or just knowing what they were getting into and being comfortable with that. You know, there's the people, you know, there's someone who kind of goes, well, I can't afford that, so I'll get the $100 spaceship. And he goes and visits it once a week in the hangar, who is waiting for the moment where you can take off and leave the hangar doors. But if that doesn't come...
it's so tragic and just so... and comic. It's just this... It sounds like something from a dystopian novel that's like, not grand dystopia, but just like the tiny tragedies of the shitty future where people sort of, they don't even live in virtual universes. They're not even living their fake virtual life. They can't have their fake virtual life. Their fake virtual life is denied to them. And they just get to live like a sample of what that fake virtual life would be like if they could not
really... You get to vote for your wallet for something that might not exist.
Just getting in the ship in the hangar and not being able to leave.
Like, I think parts of it will definitely happen. Like, I think the single player game will happen. I think the, you know, the dogfighting and stuff will get fleshed out, and the racing and the other stuff they're working on. And perhaps even, you know, they will get to the point where they've made an Elite style game, big open world trading thing. How good the FPS combat will be, or how well the MMO will work. There are just a billion potential things that could go slightly wrong. It's the most extraordinary exercise. But you don't want to be the person saying it can't be done. So...
Good luck to them.
Good luck. Yeah, good luck. Good luck. And if you're spending loads of money on it, good for you. I hope you know what you're getting out of it, because no one else does. That is all the questions we've got time for.
You can send us questions at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. You can put questions on our forum. You can just put them there. CreightonCrowbar.com/forum.
When it's up, that is.
Yeah.
It's up now.
Is it?
Yeah. We have been having some intermittent server issues. We're going to try and fix one way or another.
Related to the forum in some way?
Yeah, when the forum is busy, it seems to wound the site. and so we'll figure that out. But yeah.
Just jealous.
It's up at the moment.
You can also send us questions on Twitter, at CreightonCrowbar. And you can follow us on Twitter individually. I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at Marsh Davis. It's DAVIES.
I'm at C Thurston. That's CTHURSTEN.
Hello, everybody.
Bye.
Honk.